This is The God Show, a conversation about the human spirit with your host, Pat McMahon.
So a while back, some time ago, I was at a radio station, news radio, talk, sports, really serving the whole state of Arizona and really well thought of across the United States. Why am I telling you about my career? Because the general manager of that radio station, KTAR, in Phoenix, Arizona, was a delightful guy to work with, fun, a taskmaster, hard-nosed guy when he needed to be, but he was absolutely rigid when it comes to anyone interrupting a staff meeting. It's very important to him that the flow of the staff meeting not be interrupted. Unless he had a personal call on his cell phone from somebody who was in booze trouble. And my friend, the general manager, was that person's sponsor. If you don't know what that's all about, this hour is going to be really informative to you, because Jim Tazarak would get up, excuse himself to the staff, say, "Carry on, everybody. You can do this without me," and he's gone. No matter what was going on, he's gone to fulfill the obligation that he had to that part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, this part of Alcoholics Anonymous is named Dawn Eden Goldstein. And she is not only our guest on The God Show, but the author of a compelling book called Father Ed, the story of Bill W.'s spiritual sponsor. So, Dawn, as I welcome you to the show, after a very, very long introduction that I hope you'll excuse, thank you very much for the book. Thank you for the stories. Thank you for the inspiration. And I'm going to thank you in advance for telling us about Father Edward Dowling, a Jesuit priest who influenced the creation of Alcoholics Anonymous. Was he an alcoholic?
No, Father Ed, like myself, wasn't an alcoholic. And for that reason, he called himself underprivileged, because as he came to know people of Alcoholics Anonymous, he so admired them. He admired their fellowship. He admired the directness with which they spoke about their problems and also about God, that he felt himself underprivileged for not being part of them.
What attracted you, though, to the cause, not being an alcoholic yourself? Was there somebody in your family?
Well, no, actually, but I did know a Jesuit who was important to me, Father Francis Canavan, who died in 2009, and he had been an alcoholic, and he was an advisor to a Catholic fellowship for alcoholics called the Calyx Society. And so when I learned from an alcoholic friend of mine about Father Ed, who died in 1960 before I was born, and I learned that he was a non-alcoholic who was very important in the early years of AA, I was really touched by his story, because I was touched that a priest who wasn't an alcoholic himself would choose to spend, you know, 20 years of his life as a close friend and spiritual mentor to Bill Wilson, the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous.
And there's a disproportionate number of alcoholics. I mean, people with serious problems, not just in the clergy, but in the priesthood, right?
Oh, you mean a disproportionate number of alcoholics in the priesthood? You know, I'm not aware of statistics, but I will say that in my personal experience, and I have a doctorate in sacred theology, I've taught at seminaries, I have seen that in a profession where people are often alone, you know, such as,
yes,
you know, the parish priesthood where a priest is the only priest living at a parish. Often, you know, I've seen there is the temptation to drink because the being alone goes from, you know, solitude, which can be a healthy thing, to isolation, which isn't healthy. And that's a dangerous situation for someone who's prone to alcoholism.
And I can ask you that as an Irish Catholic who went to Catholic school, Catholic college, producer Rosemary Scarfo, former Ursula nun. So we have we have the freedom to be able to ask you that because we have been acquainted with enough members of the priesthood and the clergy in general, but mostly the priesthood because of that isolation, because of that aloneness. So often, they will openly acknowledge that sometimes the bottle was their closest companion.
Yes, and that's very sad. One of the things that Father Ed Dowling did, which I write about in my biography of him, Father Ed, the story of Bill W.'s spiritual sponsor, is that he did minister not only to lay people who were alcoholics, but also to alcoholic priests. I would have liked to have written more about his ministry to priests, but I was prevented by this strange rule at the Dowling Archive at Maryville University, where his papers are kept. Even though Father Dowling died in 1960, and any priests to whom he ministered are, you know, very likely no longer with us, still at the archive, they have a very, you know, hard like ban on researchers going through any material related to alcoholic priests.
Oh, I'm sure there's a great deal of sensitivity on that subject.
Well, there is, and at the same time, even though people's anonymity needs to be preserved, it is important to talk about the problem, and that was something important that Father Ed Dowling did at a time in the from 1940 when he first learned of Alcoholics Anonymous, which was very early in AA's history, until his death in 1960. He was talking, you know, without breaching people's anonymity, he was talking about the problem of alcoholism and the need for pastoral caregivers to be present for alcoholics, a need that certainly still exists today.
Father Ed, the story of Bill W.'s spiritual sponsor, and we have the author, Dawn Eden Goldstein, on The God Show for this hour to talk about both men. Before he met Bill Wilson, though, the co-founder of AA, Father Ed was a pretty interesting guy himself. Tell us a little bit. Tell us a little bit biographically about Father Ed Dowling.
Well, Father Ed had a lot of things in his background and in his personality that later made him able to empathize with alcoholics, even though he wasn't one, and it made him an appealing person to be around for many alcoholics. For one thing, he didn't initially intend to be a priest. He wanted to be a pro baseball player, and he was a baseball star in high school at what's now St. Louis University High, and in college at a Jesuit college that he had attended in Kansas. He tried out for the majors, was told he wasn't quite good enough, and then he became a journalist at a daily newspaper, the St. Louis Globe Democrat, where he worked for a year before becoming a Jesuit. So he'd had some life experience before entering religious life. Another interesting thing about him is that he really struggled in his formation as a Jesuit because he sensed his personal unworthiness. He had a very kind of high understanding of the priesthood and of the, you know, personality of the Jesuit in particular. You know, he was living at a time when Jesuits were really idealized as God's Marines, you know, the elite of the religious orders. To some degree, they still are today, but it was even more so then, especially to someone from an Irish family like Father Ed. So going into the Jesuits, he just assumed that he would instantly become holy. And when, as a Jesuit novice, you know, during his first couple of years of formation, he saw that he was still the same person with the same thoughts, he started to have a faith crisis, because here he had thought that this was his vocation, and what if he just wasn't holy enough for it? So he really needed to come to an understanding that, you know, as it said, you know, God doesn't call the perfect, he perfects the called. And he came to see that his life as a Jesuit was a very special cross that he had the opportunity to carry, and that this was how God intended to make him a saint, that he may not have been a perfect saint going in, but this was the path to holiness that God intended for him.
I've been in the company of Jesuits who either themselves or in other company at their expense would say something like, oh, are you a Jesuit, to a priest? And the priest said, no, I'm Catholic.
Well, that's actually more of a modern understanding, because, you know, since the late 1960s, the Jesuits have had a reputation for being progressive. But in Father Ed's time, the Jesuits were known for their, you know, doctrinal rigor. At the same time, in the United States, at least, the Jesuits did have, you know, a certain amount of leeway to extend their ministry into areas of public life that might not have been open to other priests. So Father Ed took advantage of that pastoral leeway that was given him, since he wasn't a parish priest, and he, you know, used that freedom to tour the country, giving talks. His first interest was democracy. He was an expert on proportional representation, what's now known as ranked choice voting. He was ahead of his time in that respect.
Yes.
Because it wasn't a thing back in the 30s and 40s. But then later on, after he met Bill Wilson and discovered AA in 1940, he toured the country really spreading the word about AA, and especially he spread the word to clergy about AA, because since AA originally had ties to a Protestant sect called the Oxford Group, there were clergy who were suspicious of AA and its talk of a higher power. They thought it might be a cult. And Father Ed had a very important historical role in convincing clergy of all faiths, not just Catholics, that if a member of the faithful discovered AA, it wouldn't take that person away from his or her faith. It would actually help him or her go deeper into the faith that the person had.
Well, as a Jesuit, of course, he also had the reputation as being a part of academic excellence, which they're noted for, and most recently, of course, noted as the Order of the Pope. But
yes.
But in those days, though, Father Ed was so many things, a gentle soul and also an academic. But how did he discover AA to begin with?
Well, he discovered AA through a reporter friend of his who was a terrible drunk and whose alcoholism had caused his wife to go to her family with their two young daughters. This newspaper man came to see Father Ed just for help, and Father Ed managed to reunite the newspaper man with his wife, and extracted a promise from this reporter that he wouldn't drink. But at that time, in early 1940, AA had yet to spread nationally. It didn't yet exist in St. Louis, where Father Ed was based. And so Father Ed couldn't recommend, because he didn't know about it, couldn't recommend that this reporter go to AA. So then a few weeks later, Father Ed visited this reporter in Chicago, where the reporter lived, and the reporter, you know, said that he had been hanging out with his alcoholic newspaper friends in this group called Alcoholics Anonymous. And Father Ed was concerned about this. It sounded strange, but then he went to an AA meeting and received a copy of the big book, and he was really taken, first just at the meeting, he was taken with the stories that people told of the meeting, you know, the fellowship at the meeting, that the stories that people told and the fellowship that they had. He recognized that here was something where people were healing in community, where people were able to be wounded healers to one another. That intrigued him, and he was also intrigued by the big book of AA, which includes the method that AA uses for its members to attain and keep their sobriety. It's a method known as the 12 steps. And a Jesuit friend of Father Ed's pointed out to him that the spiritual principles in the 12 steps of AA were very similar to the principles in the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius Loyola, the founder of the Jesuits. So once Father Ed was made aware of the similarities between the spirituality of his own religious order, the Jesuits, and the spirituality of AA, he made it a point of tracking down Bill Wilson to meet him personally, to find out, was Bill actually drawing inspiration from St. Ignatius Loyola? And Bill responded, "Never heard of him." And Father Ed loved that. He laughed. He really loved that. And as it happened, Father Ed met Bill at a crisis point in Bill's personal history. And Father Ed was able to help Bill through that crisis. And from then on, Bill considered Father Ed his spiritual sponsor, the one who was helping Bill to really live the spirituality of the 12 steps.
What was the attraction, though, of those two people, so totally disparate, so dramatically removed from one another, the origins and the causes and the professionalism, and yet Father Ed and Bill W. just clicked. Why?
Well, I think something has to do with the interaction that they had when they first met. After Bill told Father Ed that he'd never heard of St. Ignatius Loyola, and Father Ed laughed, Bill began to warm to Father Ed. You know, the two of them were alone in the room where Bill was living at the time with his wife Lois at the AA clubhouse in New York. And Bill, you know, sensed that Father Ed was someone to whom he could open up about the frustrations that he had since AA had yet to take off. So as Bill was speaking to Father Ed about his frustrations, Father Ed responded to him, "Blessed are they who hunger and thirst." He gave him Jesus' words from the Beatitudes. And then when Bill said to him, "Well, won't there be any satisfaction?" Father Ed said, "No, never." And somehow Bill received this as good news, because what Father Ed impressed upon Bill was really, you know, the teaching of St. Augustine, the ancient teaching that Augustine says in his Confessions when he says, "O Lord, you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you." Father Ed impressed upon Bill that this thirst, which Bill had thought was such a great burden, was actually a gift from God. And the question was, where was Bill going to direct his thirst? Was he going to direct it at things lower than him, such as drinking or such as success for AA? Or was he going to direct his thirst at something higher? Was he going to thirst for God? And Father Ed impressed upon Bill that if Bill directed his thirst to God, then every time Bill ministered to a member of AA, then Bill would encounter God, just as in Matthew 25, Jesus says that whatever you did for the least of these, you did for me.
And there are people now, Dawn, who are listening in different parts of the world who are saying, wait, just a second. Not just Alcoholics Anonymous, but virtually every 12-step program for every kind of dependency and addiction began with this concept. Give us a little background, just a smidgen of a bio on Bill Wilson before Father Ed and how his origins brought him to the beginnings of something that had this incredible, almost messianic impact on people's lives.
Yes, Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 Steps of AA truly have had, as you say, a transformative effect on untold millions of people's lives throughout the world. So Bill was born in 1895, so he was 3 years older than Father Ed, and he had married and become a stockbroker in New York, but his downfall was his terrible alcoholism, which, you know, like as with many others in the stock market, became, you know, even worse when the stock market crashed during the Great Depression. And at a time when Bill was absolutely at his worst as an alcoholic, and it looked like there would be nothing more for him than to spend the rest of his life in a mental unit, because at that time, before AA, there was no treatment for alcoholics that had been shown to consistently work. So when Bill was hitting bottom, he encountered a friend of his who had recently become dry through this Protestant group called the Oxford Group. And the friend encouraged Bill to find God, and upon finding God, to really try to practice certain principles that would help Bill to straighten out himself spiritually. So Bill didn't believe in God at that point, but when his alcoholism got so bad that he had to check himself into a facility for drunks, at one point he just, sitting on his bed in this facility, cried out, "If there is a God, let him show himself." And at that moment, Bill Wilson experienced a divine inbreaking, this experience of light and peace, and just the knowledge that God really existed, God cared about him. And from then on, Bill became sober, and with the help of his friend, Ebby, the friend from the Oxford group, Bill developed the principles that would later become, that he would later write into the 12 steps. One thing that Bill knew was that he could only stay sober if he helped other alcoholics to get sober. And so he tried for many months to do this without success, until finally, when he was on a business trip to Akron, Ohio, in June 1935, May 1935, he encountered, he was seeking out an alcoholic because he was tempted to drink, and he thought the only way he could avoid drinking was to find an alcoholic there in Akron whom he could help get sober. Mm. So he met Dr. Bob Smith, and Dr. Bob Smith was the first alcoholic whom Bill actually was able to help get sober. And so together they founded Alcoholics Anonymous.
And what is remarkable, it's been so many years since then, and as we talked earlier, there have been so many millions that have been touched by this program.
Yes.
And the two names, Bill W. and Dr. Bob, if you say to anyone who's been through the program, or a family member of somebody that has been helped with AA, the two names that always come up and are never forgotten, Bill W. and Dr. Bob, and they are said with such reverence.
It's so true.
There's something about this, though, that particularly attracts me, because the phrase higher power,
yes,
is such an important part of it. And I always felt that meant you could embrace Buddhists and you could embrace Hindu alcoholics and you could embrace Baha'i, and that higher power was so general that it wasn't a matter of opening the doors of just one church.
That's it. That's exactly right. And I'm so glad that you brought this up. And this is the point that Father Ed Dowling made when speaking to clergy about AA, that AA doesn't take a person away from whatever their belief is in terms of faith, but it rather strengthens them in whatever faith they have. And even atheists and agnostics can benefit from the 12 steps, the method used by AA and used by other recovery programs, because the 12 steps are based on the idea that a power we came to believe, this is the second step, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. So, you know, the idea is that our addictions, whether it's alcohol or any kind of addiction or addictive behavior, these addictions are based on turning in upon ourselves and getting so wrapped up in ourselves that we feel that we're stuck. That we can't get out. We need to believe that there's some power greater than ourselves that can help us and give us the strength to overcome. So for atheists who are part of 12-step groups, you know, they may make their higher power the group itself. You know, myself as a believer, I don't believe that that's the same experience as the experience of one who believes in God. But still, I can't begrudge atheists the real experiences of recovery that they've had just by believing that the group or anything is greater than themselves. They've had real recovery. Another important point with regard to the 12 steps is that they don't impose a particular kind of God upon people. The 12 steps specify twice that they're referring to God as we understand him. So each person goes into AA with his or her own conception of what is, you know, that person's higher power. Is it, you know, the Jewish or Christian God? Is it the group itself? Is it some kind of universal spirit? Whatever it is, if people recognize that they can receive strength beyond their own strength through the intercession of this higher power, that's what can pull people through and enable them to work the steps to gain and maintain sobriety.
I find it particularly interesting hearing you as a non-alcoholic talk about those things spiritually, because though it had nothing to do with moving from dependency to sobriety, you did have your own conversion from Judaism to Catholicism.
Yes, that is true. And I think you're absolutely right in that as someone who has had a spiritual experience, I can identify with Bill Wilson's spiritual experience, and I can identify with the experience of people who really need divine intervention or some kind of intervention from outside to help them to get their lives in order. In my case, I had suffered different kinds of trauma, including sexual abuse as a child. I grew up with various wounds that led me to become an agnostic, and suffered from terrible cyclical suicidal depression, which I now know was the effect of the PTSD that I had, undiagnosed. The PTSD was undiagnosed for many years. And when I was 31, after becoming gradually open to the idea that maybe God really did exist and maybe God really did care about me, I had a spiritual experience that, like Bill's experience, although I didn't see, you know, a flash of light, I did come to believe that God really existed, that God cared about me. And once I had this spiritual experience, I was saved from the really disturbing temptations that I'd had to harm myself or even to kill myself. You know, from then on, you know, even though I've had times when I've had anxiety, I've had times when I needed to get therapy or get medication, I've felt a certain kind of control over harmful thoughts that I didn't have before. And I have to believe that this control that I have now is due to the healing that I received from my own higher power, whom I've come to recognize as the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Jesus Christ.
And your troubles also bring to mind one of the cleverest phrases I've ever seen written in the English language, and that is yours: the thrill of the chaste, chaste. Talk about that to the audience. I want to share that with them, because you're not only a delightful conversationalist, you're very, very clever in the use of the language.
Oh, well, thank you, Pat. I appreciate it. I wrote that book and the title at a time when I was working in New York City newspapers. I'd actually worked for a time as a headline writer at the New York Post. So one has to be very good with puns to be a headline writer at the Post, and always loved puns. And, you know, with The Thrill of the Chaste, that was my first book, and I wrote about my experiences as a new Christian when I was having to unlearn, you know, certain sexual behaviors that were not only not, you know, accepted by Christianity, you know, namely having sexual activity outside of marriage, but also these behaviors hadn't made me happy. They hadn't been fulfilling. Mm-hmm. And at that time, the only books that I could find on chastity, apart from Augustine's Confessions, the only books that I could find were books on abstinence till marriage. And so those books aren't really helpful for someone who's you know, in her 30s and has, you know, had a life as a rock and roll journalist in New York City.
Yes.
So as I began to learn about what chastity was, I wrote a book on it. I've since rewritten that book to make it applicable to people in any state of life. I mean, it's still primarily in the new edition for The Thrill of the Chaste is for primarily for single people. But I also talk about married chastity because, you know, married chastity, it certainly includes what theologians call the marital act. You know, it includes sexual union, but it also includes faithfulness. It includes looking at one's spouse as a human being and not as one's, you know, personal sex object.
Yes.
And, you know, marital chastity includes fidelity. It includes not being unfaithful through, you know, emotional friendships with others or with, and it includes, you know, not being unfaithful through pornography. So, you know, I think chastity is a good word. It's gotten a bad rap. And I think it's that everyone, whether they're married or unmarried, could have a happier life if they learned what chastity really is.
And there are 12-step programs dealing with human sexuality in all of their forms. And it's one of the reasons I wanted to bring that up. Besides AA, and that organization that probably one can safely say is what it is today because of Bill W., because of Dr. Bob, but because of Father Ed and his relationship with both of them. Our guest, Dawn Eden Goldstein, who wrote Father Ed, is going to tell us a little bit now more about the fact that they met, and we've kind of left them there inspiring one another. But what caused AA to finally explode, Dawn? Was Father Ed involved in that?
Yes, he was, actually, interestingly enough. And his role in the explosion of AA hasn't really gotten credit until I wrote my biography, Father Ed, The Story of Bill W.'s Spiritual Sponsor. If people know about the spread of AA, they will usually know that AA began to spread after a writer for the Saturday Evening Post, which was a hugely popular weekly magazine in 1941. This writer, whose name was Jack Alexander, did an investigative story on AA. And at first, when he was given the assignment, he thought, as an investigative reporter, that he was being put on. You know, he went to New York to meet Bill Wilson and to go to AA meetings there. And he thought that the people he met at AA meetings were Broadway actors pretending that they had been such terrible drunks and were now so sober. And then Bill connected Jack with the few other AA groups that were in the country. And, you know, mainly at that time, there were groups in Akron, Ohio, where AA had started, outside of New York, Akron, Ohio, Cleveland, Ohio, Chicago, and St. Louis, where Father Ed had recently helped to start an AA chapter. And so Jack Alexander was from St. Louis, and as he began to go to these different cities on his way to finally ending up in his hometown of St. Louis, he gradually started to get over his skepticism about AA. But it wasn't until Jack Alexander came to St. Louis and saw this group that Father Ed had helped start that he realized that it was for real, because that was when Jack Alexander saw some of the journalists whom he had known when he was starting out, and they were in AA, and he knew they couldn't be faking it because he knew what lushes they had been, and now they were sober and they were sane. So it was really through Father Ed's starting the St. Louis chapter of AA that this reporter, Jack Alexander, was able to write this story for the Saturday Evening Post, saying that AA works, that it's the first program for healing, recovery from alcoholism to show any real effectiveness. And it was with that Saturday Evening Post story that AA started to take off around the country.
Dawn, do you know that just with these stories that you're talking to me and us and all of the people who are listening, just those stories alone, I know, are causing some people who have proudly embraced the tenets of Alcoholics Anonymous are gathering family members around the radio saying, they say, no, this is what I'm talking about, guys. Hey, listen, this is what happened and this is why. So influential, the founders, but then also all those sponsors that are there when you call, like that story I told at the beginning.
Yes, that's right. So in Alcoholics Anonymous, a sponsor is someone who helps another member to work the 12 steps to attain and maintain sobriety. A sponsor is usually, you know, someone who has a bit of experience working the 12 steps, who has been through all the 12 steps. Now, Bill Wilson, the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, referred to Father Ed Dowling, the subject of my biography, Father Ed. Bill Wilson referred to Father Ed as his spiritual sponsor, mm-hmm. because even though Father Ed wasn't an alcoholic, it was Father Ed's spiritual guidance that helped Bill Wilson go deeper into his own working the 12 steps. And it helped, Father Ed really helped Bill to gain a deeper level of sobriety and sanity.
In doing research, though, did you find that you were left with a feeling that Alcoholics Anonymous, no matter how successful they've been, is it a forgiving organization? What happens when I fall off the wagon and I have just that one more, two more, six more drinks?
I'm so glad that you asked that question. I subscribe to The Grapevine, which is the AA International newsletter. Mm-hmm. And in The Grapevine, people write in with their own stories about their experiences of AA. And one thing that people write again and again is that AA never turns people away because they slip. It never shames people if they slip. It's like in the Gospels where Peter asks Jesus, "How many times shall I forgive my brother if he offends me? Seven?" And Jesus says, "No, 70 times seven," which mm-hmm. really means an infinite number. So no matter how often an alcoholic slips, relapses, that alcoholic is always welcome at any AA meeting throughout the world, because the only requirement for membership in AA is a desire to stop drinking.
You know, for somebody who has been fortunate enough not to have that serious a drinking problem in my family, but with friends who are alive today because of AA, I'm indebted to you for this broadcast. As I said at the beginning, we've been doing this about 24 years now, and this is the kind of subject and the kind of presentation that of itself it changes lives. Yeah. And I'm also indebted to you, Dawn, for bringing up something like the Saturday Evening Post and having to explain to people that it was a magazine from antediluvian days.
That's right.
And I now have to say yes, but I remember Norman Rockwell did the covers of so many of the
yes.
Saturday Evening Post magazines. But that was an important part of it. You know what? I was confused when I was reading the book that we've been talking about for this hour on The God Show. I was confused because, Dawn, as a fellow Catholic, I've also been privileged to visit Rome and to visit the Basilica, St. Peter's, and to stand in that remarkable area surrounded by the statues of all of those sainted people in the history of the church. And yet I don't ever remember seeing the likeness carved in marble of St. Puggy.
St. Puggy. Well, that's something I write about at the end of the book. So Father Edward Dowling's nickname was Puggy. And at the very end of Father Ed, I figure if a person has read through, 378 pages of this biography, then maybe they believe, like I do, that Father Ed was a saint. I'm careful in introducing that because, I don't want people to think that my belief in Father Ed's holiness makes it, impossible for me to write about him with any kind of objectivity. On the contrary, Father Ed did have human failings, and I discuss those in the book as well. But I've interviewed many people who knew him, and, for any human failings that they mention, they mention how he really worked at being a good person. He suffered from a crippling form of arthritis, so that after having been this great athlete in high school and college, by the time he was 30, he was walking as though he had a steel pole up his back because his spine was calcified. Soon after, he was walking with a cane. And so, you know, Father Ed, you know, despite his lack of mobility, just poured himself into his work with alcoholics and anyone who had a problem. So, you know, by the end of my research, I just felt like, you know, I really hope that people reading this book, if they believe that he should be a saint, I hope they write to the Archbishop of St. Louis, who has the power to introduce Father Ed's cause for sainthood. And I hope they tell him, because if there's enough grassroots movement from people who believe in Father Ed's sanctity, then we might have a, again, to use Father Ed's nickname, a Saint Puggy. That's my hope.
Wouldn't that be terrific? The next time that I have the opportunity and the honor to go to St. Peter's, I'll be looking for Saint Puggy. By the way, we're talking with Dawn Eden Goldstein, who has not only written about Father Ed, but I think has been touched by him. And we continue to be touched, we who have already read the book. And I'm not here to sell books, but I will tell you that you will find yourself not only in the company of the author of Thrill of the Chaste that we talked about before, but you'll also find out why it is that this holy man would be called Saint Puggy, but you'll also become a kind of an authority on dum-dum thinking. Help us with that.
Oh, well, dum-dum thinking is something that I refer to in the introduction of Father Ed. So Father Ed, when he was a Jesuit seminarian, he read an article in the Scientific American on what the author called dum-dum thinking, with the idea being that there are two different kinds of thinkers. There are thinkers who have these thoughts that are like, you know, armor-piercing bullets, where the thought just goes straight to its target. And we would call those people maybe linear thinkers. And then there are people who make lateral connections between things, but who have trouble focusing on one single train of thought and following it all the way to its end. And so the author of this Scientific American article compared those thinkers to dum-dum bullets that cause, you know, lateral damage. I mean, it's a violent image, unfortunately. But in the introduction to Father Ed, I talk about how Father Ed thought of himself as a dum-dum thinker, which, you know, he really was. If one thinks of, you know, dum-dum thinking in terms of, again, not the stupidity dum-dum, but like the dum-dum bullet, lateral thinking. Father Ed was a kind of, you know, jack of all trades, master of none. He was really good at connecting people. He was what Malcolm Gladwell would call a connector. Mm. So when people would come to his office with any kind of problem, he would find someone else who had that problem, and he would help them to start their own support group. So he wasn't the kind of pastoral caregiver who insisted on, you know, controlling the lives of people whom he ministered to, or even in a, you know, there are many pastoral caregivers who, without trying to be controlling at all, still, you know, become spiritual fathers or spiritual mothers to the extent where the person can become dependent upon them like a guru. And Father Ed was not like that. He was a mentor, but not a guru. His way of influencing people was by bringing wounded people together in fellowship to help and minister to one another. So, like, for example, when women came to his office who had suffered miscarriages. He formed a support group for them, for women who had suffered pregnancy loss. This is in, you know, the 1950s, when nobody was talking about these things. Another thing he did with women, if they came to his office, you know, talking about problems because they had so many children, he formed a support group for women with seven or more children, and he named it after his favorite drink, 7-Up. And he did the same for, you know, for drug addicts and for people who suffered from scrupulosity, which is a kind of OCD. It was really his gift. And, you know, he would tell people that he really didn't do anything. He just happened to be around. But those who were around him knew that he had this great gift for encouraging and really helping to create fellowship. And that was something that really helped to bring him close to his dear friend, Bill Wilson, the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous.
I never felt when I was reading the book also that he singled out alcohol as being the devil's beverage, that of itself, it was not the brewers and it was not the distillers who were creating sin throughout mankind. I think he seemed to recognize the fact that it was wine at the wedding at Cana.
Well, yes. I mean, Father Ed was not a temperance crusader.
Yes.
And so in that way, he was different from some other Catholic priests of his time who were preaching what they called total abstinence from alcohol. You know, Father Ed didn't, you know, begrudge people if they had other systems that worked for them in terms of avoiding, you know, becoming alcoholics. But, you know, to Father Ed, you know, the important thing was that if people did suffer from problems with alcohol, that they know that AA was there for them to help them. And so he did everything in his power to promote awareness of AA and other 12-step programs.
With only a couple of minutes left in an hour that I think for me could go on for a long, long time with Dawn Eden Goldstein, the author of Father Ed, the story of Bill W.'s spiritual sponsor, Bill W. at the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous. With just a couple of minutes then, let me ask you about the fact that since he then left us in 1960, do you think that Father Ed left anything undone?
That's a great question. I think that whatever Father Ed may have left undone has been picked up by every 12-step fellowship. Father Ed was more responsible than anyone else of his time for promoting the idea that, as you mentioned, these 12 steps are not only for alcoholics, they're for anyone struggling with any kind of addiction or compulsion or unwanted behavior. It was Father Ed who really saw and promoted that wider application of the 12 steps.
I find that in conversing with you on the subject of Father Ed and Alcoholics Anonymous, that I'm beginning to suffer from my own dependency, and that is the writing style of Dawn Eden Goldstein. So with just a minute left, I ask you, in advance, do you have a book coming out pretty soon?
I don't have a new one coming out, but I'm hoping to write a biography of another great Jesuit, Father Louis Toomey, who was a civil rights hero. So I ask listeners to please pray that I can get a grant to write that, because it's not something that, you know, publishers seeking a bestseller would want, but it's something that needs to be written.
Well, as a matter of fact, while you're asking people to pray and send you good thoughts, I think probably all you have to do is ask for a miracle from St. Puggy.
That's right. Believe me, I'm asking for that too.
Don, it's been a delight. The book Father Ed, once again, no, we don't sell books here, but I wouldn't really object to you picking up a copy. It's from Orbis Books, Maryknoll, New York, and the name is Father Ed, which happens to be the story of Bill W.'s spiritual sponsor. And all I can say to you, Dawn Eden Goldstein, after a delightful conversation about an equally delightful human being, Father Ed, this is Pat McMahon on The God Show, and Sunday will never be the same.